It's time for Architecture, Coffee, and Ink. Hello, this is Hollywood C, and you're listening to Architecture, Coffee, and Ink, a podcast dedicated to introducing concepts, detailing out designs, and tackling the architecture you might not realize the meaning behind. I'm your hostess, and I'm here today to start introducing you to the designs that make you wonder why. So I ask you to brew your coffee, grab your sketchbook and pen, and let's begin. Hello everyone, and welcome to the first Eerie Arc episode of the year. We made it through the first month of the year. If you are a new listener, this is a once a month special where I discuss architecture, projects, designs, and the darker and spookier side of it all. And today's episode was one of the two buildings most heavily requested to be part of our Eerie Arc series. Due to how close the number of requests were, I decided to do both of them. As the title of the episode tells you, we are going to be talking about the Sagamore Hotel, located in Bolton Landing, New York, for today's episode. The other project is actually going to be talked about for February's episode, as this is technically January's, which comes out at the end of the month. And I am actually going to leave it as a surprise for exactly which haunted location we will talk about then. But for this episode, remember, this is going to be covering the paranormal and several deaths, in addition to our regular dose of history and architecture. If that's not for you, no worries. Please enjoy the normal episode that came out last Monday, or wait for next Monday's weekly release, which is just architecture and design. And with that out of the way, remember to always check your sources, check your facts, and most importantly, check me. I should never be your only source of information. The Sagamore Hotel is a currently operating hotel located on Lake George in Bolton Landing, New York, in the Adirondack Mountains. This building has a complex history, even starting with the region it calls home. Officially, it has burned twice and has three versions of it, each one built on top of the other. But is that really the whole story? Especially given that the current hotel has managed to hit the top spot on list for both its elegant design and as one of the most haunted hotels in America. In fact, the Today magazine named it one of their top 10 most haunted hotels, and they haven't been the only ones. Prior to the creation of the hotel, this area of New York, close to what is now the Vermont border, was first inhabited in the prehistoric Stone Age, from 5000 to 10,000 BC, according to Bolton's Landing Chamber of Commerce website. Apparently, legends of sacrifice have been associated pretty far back with this area, as the website went on to detail a story of a beautiful maiden who was burned at the stake when her young lover, a warrior chief, had gone off to battle, leaving her behind. When they killed her, a spirit whisked her body away, and since then, warriors were often found on what is called the Sacrificial Stone, located on the Mohican Point. This is on the mainland, a mere 4-minute drive just over a mile away from the hotel. This area, and the island the hotel currently calls home, remained occupied by indigenous tribes, as they would use the area for hunting and fishing. They called the area Andieteracti, according to the Opal Collections website, which they said translates to where mountains touch the water, and that is how the area remained until the arrival of Western colonizers from Europe. The first of these were actually the French, who were led by Father Isaac Yogues in 1646. It wasn't too long before the British also showed up, and the area was drenched in the tides of war. It was part of both the French and Indian War, which is basically a parallel battlefield of the Seven Years' War that had been raging in Europe. It also saw battle during the American Revolution. This is going to be pretty important, as the book, The Last of the Mohicans, by James Fenimore Cooper, would actually cover some of these events. And in honor of that, several of the names and locations in the area are going to refer to the book and its character. In fact, this Sagamore was named after someone from the book, a chief, which is what the word means. So if you hear any familiar names, it was in fact done on purpose to match the theme. The lake, however, was renamed by the French to be the Lac du Saint-Sacrement, then later renamed to Lake George by the British after King George II, the grandfather of America's least favorite monarch, King George III, who they declared independence from. Jumping forward into history, we are going to start the story of the hotel in the 1880s. By this time, Lake George had become a hotbed for summer leisurely activities, so much so that the local millionaires were feeling a bit miffed that so many of the so-called commoners were hanging around and also daring to enjoy the same lake. Most of these millionaires had homes either in the area or in the nearby Millionaire Row, which, as the name suggests, was a row of mansions and estates. My research led me to believe that most of these residents would have been summer residents, meaning that it was just their lake house, and they would have had another primary home when they worked in the cities, predominantly in either New York City or Philadelphia. A hotelier in the area, a man named Myron Brown, came up with the idea of creating a hotel. But more than that, a resort to draw in guests and provide a social club. Brown was the manager of the Mohican House Hotel in Bolton Landing and already had experience within the hospitality industry. So he gathered 4 millionaires from Philadelphia with places on the lake, making them Lake George residents to fund the project. They bought the entire island, which was named Green Island, and it has remained a private island ever since. It was purchased for a total of $30,000. They created the Green Island Improvement Company and later extended an offer to have John Bolton Simpson to join, where he would eventually become president of the company. All of them had a cottage on the ground, and some of these actually still exist. The foremen were E. Burgess Warren, William B. Bedman, Robert Glendenning, and George Burnham. As soon as it opened in 1883, it was a success almost immediately. It was a design by the Wilson Brothers and Company, an architecture firm from Philly who had worked on bridges and railroads and had designed such projects as part of the original Drexel University and the 1876 Centennial Exposition. As the designers of the primary building during the exposition, they had an international reputation by the time they designed this building. The first design was built with a focus on finding harmony with nature. Brown oversaw the construction of the hotel and became the manager until 1905, because if you're going to start a project, at least make sure to bake in a job opportunity while you do it. It was originally $4 a night or $25 for a week's stay, and to give this context, while this literally translates with inflation to $120 a night in today's terms, that's not really an accurate estimate of the cost. From my understanding, it would be closer to renting a room at the Ritz-Carlton or the Waldorf for the night or week, with the added element of being a boys' club. And most people stayed here for weeks or months at a time over the summer. When you use those automatic online converters, they really can't include the human element into the mix. They're wonderful, I use them a lot, but in this situation, it really doesn't give the whole story, because just because you could afford it doesn't mean they would let you in. In one famous story, a later owner of the hotel was actually turned away when attempting to check in as a guest, way before he came to own it. Obviously, he could afford a room for the night, but it didn't really matter to the owners at the time because they considered him the quote wrong sort, and it was quite the undertaking to get there, as the most common form of transportation involved taking a train to the closest village and then taking a stagecoach from there to the hotel. So you could be looking at days of travel depending upon where you came from. The original hotel was designed in Queen Anne style and was considered to be a Victorian era resort, a tag you will see added to it even today. Stanley Turkle, CMHS, a historian, author, and expert in hotels, collected a few quotes in an article he wrote for hotelonline.com. One of these was a quote from a photographer named Seneca Ray Stoddard, who covered the opening of the hotel and had the following to say about the original opening. Quote, "The hotel building stands on high ground and commands, on every side, extended views of the lake and mountains. It is built in the style popularly supposed to belong to the 16th century. Its varied porticos, balconies, and gables all admirably displayed by the harmonious colors with which it is painted. Within will be found every hotel convenience and comfort, including hydraulic passenger elevator, electric bells, telegraph office, etc. Many of the rooms are arranged in suite with outside entrances, and all rooms are illuminated with the Edison electric light. Aquatic amusements need not languish in want of means for enjoyment, as a fleet of boats of various kinds will be found at the landing, ranging from the tiny skiff to the comfortable steam yacht. From the ample dock, broad drives and walks lead through overhanging trees up to the south front of the hotel and along the western shore of the island to the handsome rustic bridge which connects it with the mainland," end quote. After reading those original words, I can't help but be nostalgic for a building I've never experienced. Tragedy struck it barely a decade after its first opening in 1893. A fire burned the place to the ground. This fire started in the laundry building, but spread quickly to the rest of the property in June 1893. 150 guests and employees were on the property at that time, and I found the following quote about the fire from the Craftsman Bungalow website, which was taken from the Lake George Mirror, a local newspaper. This quote is from an employee of the hotel and describes the fire. Quote, "The flames wreathed the balconies and pillars with glittering gems of fiery lacework. The windows were illuminated. Then the fire showed through the boards, intertwining and spreading and twisting into a thousand glowing scintillations," end quote. The owners rebuilt immediately and included additions such as private bathrooms, more electric lights, parlors, and elevators. It took 90 men 11 months to rebuild the hotel. However, this time was in the Georgian colonial style. Most importantly, this is when the signature turret is changed from a round into an octagonal turret, and the roof line was redesigned. For some reason, I found a few articles and another original newspaper article that seemed to indicate another fire in 1895. However, I realized that there is a steamboat and another Sagamore in Pennsylvania, so I'm going to go with what seems to be the official stance of the hotel, that there were only two fires, but if anyone knows differently or has access to other sources, please let me know. Either way, the hotel was rebuilt, and the second official building was built on the stone foundations of the first, as they had survived. The second building was also designed by the Wilson brothers, and they managed to pull a lot of the original elements into the building. It also saw the inclusion of its own power plant on the property. This second period didn't last longer than 20 years, when a second fire took the resort in April 1914. This fire has never officially had a cause listed. However, it was 7 weeks prior to the start of the season, and has been strongly suspected to have been the result of arson. Unfortunately, it has never been proven and likely will remain unsolved. This second fire caused a pretty strong derailment. Unlike the first fire, which had a short construction time, this second fire resulted in the place operating on a much smaller scale, at least until the 1930s. This period of growth started out in 1921, when Dr. William G. Beckers, Adolf Ox, and Dr. Myers, and William H. Bixby financed it. Most of my sources indicated that Bixby was the primary financier and savior of the hotel, as despite the 1929 Wall Street crash, he was a St. Louis industrialist and was pretty stable throughout the entire time, and financing several other projects that would eventually become a staple in the modern day history books. All of these names were of men who were extremely important and influential at the time. From Ox, who owned and operated the New York Times, to Becker, the original stockholder of the hotel. For this building, they ended up selecting J.E.R. Carpenter of New York and Robert H. Rhinelander, an architect and engineer from Glen Falls, New York, a town 30 minutes away today. Mount Vernon was a strong influence on this design. It was primarily a three-story house with two wings flanking on each side. In 1929, Donald J. Ross, the infamous golf course architect who is already on the list for episodes to do, designed the golf course for a total price tag of $500,000. He actually planted heather that he brought over to the grounds from his home of Scotland. And after this point, the hotel flourished and hosted several historical events, including the Sagamore Horse Show, speedboat races, and the introduction of Carl P. Abbott. Abbott was another infamous name for hoteliers in New England history. Other than writing several books, he has extensive knowledge of hotels, and the ability to turn most hotels into an experience and get a profit. He actually originally said no. However, he ended up making a bet. He agreed to take over, and if he was able to turn a bigger profit than was lost in the season prior, then he wanted them to expand the hotel. He won after he imported a chef and started a catering business, and oversaw the construction and relaunch of the hotel on July 1st, 1930, and would manage the hotel for 15 seasons. And he was able to keep it afloat due to this reputation and pull the hotel through the Great Depression unscathed, with the hotel booked pretty much full all season. It was important to note that construction was ongoing during the 1929 Wall Street crash and opened through the Great Depression, which is a rather weird juxtaposition to think of that time period as one of its heydays. And yet, the hotel remained strong until 1981, when the maintenance got too much and the age of the building finally caught up to the hotel. Louis Brandt had owned it from 1946 to 1981, when it was closed down for a total of 4 seasons, as it was unable to meet the requirements for the fire codes, and the previous owner didn't have the means to get it back up to code. And so the hotel shut its doors until it was sold to Norman Wogan in 1983, another Philadelphia millionaire who started to undertake an extensive renovation. It would cost him $70 million to get it back up to snuff. He partnered with Kennington Limited, a company based in Los Angeles. They formed the Green Island Associates. They kept the property until 2008, when it was renovated for another $50 million and it joined the Opal Collection, a series of luxurious hotels and resorts all along the eastern U.S. It is 26 properties from Florida to Maine, according to their website. Currently, the hotel occupies most of the 72 acres on Green Island and has a bridge to allow access to the hotel. It is a member of the Historic Hotels of America. Due to the name changing underneath Wogan, several people refer to the current hotel when it switched back to the Sagamore in 2008 as the Sagamore the Fourth, and that's why sometimes you see it listed as having 4 hotels, especially with the extent of the renovations that were undertaken. Currently, it has a ton of patios, balconies, verandas, and 5 professional tennis courts, in addition to the various outdoor activities and amenities available. It has had an episode of Billions filmed there and won Condé Nast Traveler's Reader's Choice Awards a few times now. And it was also well known that it was the location that in 1954, Vice President Richard Nixon read the speech that President Eisenhower was supposed to read, introducing the new interstate highway system. Eisenhower had a family emergency, so Nixon presided over the conference in his stead. It was, though, Eisenhower's baby, as I mentioned in a previous episode. Now on to everyone's favorite part of the episode, the ghost stories. And there are a lot. The tragedies over its history have caused the hotel to gather ghosts like it gathers guests. And it seems like this extends as far back as when the building first opened its doors. We are going to start with the tales in the exterior and move our way in. Starting with the funniest is the tale of the Lake George Monster. In 1904, a man named Harry Walteris was in a fishing competition with a Colonel William Mann, according to Joe Nickel for the Skeptical Inquirer. It wasn't an official competition, just two men way too competitive about bass. Mann had thought it was a good idea to create a fake fish and flashed it quickly at Walteris, trying to claim he had caught a whopping 30-pound fish. However, Mann clearly should have thought twice about pranking an artist, as Walteris took it upon himself to create a lake monster from a log and scare Mann and several of their friends. After which, Walteris continued to drag it around the lake using pulley systems to terrorize the locals. Apparently, he was later asked to do it again as part of a festival. However, lake monsters continued to be part of the myth of the region for quite a while, and they had been before that. Though this happened on another part of the lake, I can't help but include this in the story. But then we get to our second story, one of the most tragic of ghosts. In the 1950s, a little boy would help out on the golf course for change. He would fetch the balls that the golfers were hitting around the course for them, and basically act as the unofficial cat. It was a common occurrence until one day. He pursued the ball onto the road where he was struck and killed by a car, as far as the story goes. If you go golfing on the property, it is said you will often hear him giggling behind the trees as he continues to fetch golf balls even in death, but with a slightly mischievous twist. Now he will move them and throw them at you, often from behind a tree, or as you are searching for them. As you approach the property, it wouldn't be weird to see people looking down into the lake from the porch or wandering around the exterior enjoying the view. However, not all of them are necessarily alive. One person who is said to get your attention is a pretty girl dressed in a lace-trimmed dress. She will often stare out at the scenery she loved when she was alive, though she will disappear when you attempt to talk with her. The favorite of all the employees is a man they have named Walter, who often rides the elevator with you, though you feel him long before you see him. People will bump into him in the elevator closest to the concierge's desk, causing him to fade into view, and ride with you in the elevator in his three-piece suit and elegant mustache. He also likes to sit in the card rooms and sit by the desk, hence making him the employee's favorite as he tends to keep them company over the long shifts. Several different couples have been seen, at least two remarkably different pairs. One pair is apparently just reliving their vacation and is seen in older clothes dating to the opening of the hotel. They head down and go to dinner before disappearing. The second is unfortunately trapped and is either seen having a peaceful dinner or having a fight, which quickly turns physical, at which they disappear at the most violent part. Another terrible tale is the maid. She was murdered during the 1930s when she was caught having an affair with a guest. After being fired, she returned to his room to attempt to talk it all out when his wife returned. Being caught with the maid still in the room, the husband confessed, and in a fit of rage, the wife attacked and smothered the maid. The husband was terrified he'd be next, and so he left with his wife and left the body of the maid to be discovered the next morning. Unfortunately, it was originally believed to have been a heart attack, and this confusion is possibly the reason she is stuck, angrily pacing the room and unable to leave the floor she was murdered on. Not all spirits are good, and the second and third floor, as well as the guest rooms themselves, are where we start to see that. A man in the long black coat, or sometimes a shadow figure, according to a few guest stories, is found frantically pacing back and forth through the hallways, trapping you in your room until sunrise. Additionally, a lady in white is said to float over you while you sleep and blow air into your eyes until you wake up. Another former guest reported a man watching them and a child running through the bed. A second woman in white wanders the halls and the restaurant and caused one of the chefs to quit. Apparently, she was having a conversation with him when the conversation ended, and she walked right through him. He tried, but was unable to calm down and ended up quitting on the spot. There are several others of questionable humanity, but what would you expect with a rumored portal to the undead on the grounds? If you are interested in experiencing this hotel, which has gorgeous, breathtaking views, make sure you go check out the website I've included in the show notes. Ghost hunting is by appointment only, but tourism is a year-round experience, though I would be the first to encourage you to try it during the summer season. It was added in 1983 to the National Register of Historic Places, and if you're interested in checking out the area or learning more about the history, there is a nearby historical society. And with that, once again, thank you so much for tuning in to this episode of our Eerie Arc. Due to a personal situation, I wasn't able to work on two episodes for this week. So, while this episode, Eerie Arc, was supposed to come out last Friday and is now coming out Monday today, I will be doing two episodes next week where I'm going to be doing a segment on Paul Revere Williams and a second episode released on the oldest national park in the world. As always, please rate, review, and subscribe everywhere you get your podcasts from. You can find me on Instagram at architecturecoffeeandinc, email the show at architecturecoffeeandinc@gmail.com, or the blog at architecturecoffeeandinc.com. Architecture Coffee and Ink is a Hollywood C Studios LLC production. I am excited to meet with all my designer, dreamers, and DIY enthusiasts next time. But in the meantime, may your coffee mugs be full and your ink wells never run dry.